Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. I wanted to give a high-level view of the Bisciotti Eric DaCosta press conference, and I did so already in about a 2.5 minute video that's out there. But this is the detailed version of that, where I'm going to delve into the questions, what I think we learned about the process, about the firing of John Harbaugh, about some other things related to the team that have not yet been addressed. Nnamdi Matabike, Justin Tucker were brought up in this press conference. So I'm going to go through that and talk a little bit about what I think I can see between the lines in addition to what was actually said during this presser. So it started off with an opening statement from Bisciotti, who said he didn't really have anything to say that wouldn't come out in the questions. Eric DaCosta then talked about it being a very disappointing season and a good opportunity to move forward. So not a lot to learn from those opening statements. Jamison Hensley asked, what was the biggest reason and when did he make the decision? Steve B said he'd had a discussion with Eric 3 to 4 weeks ago. The reasons included fourth quarter leads surrendered, underperforming the playoffs, mistakes by great players, even in those playoff games. So clearly, you know, obviously all points we're very familiar with that we don't need to bring up again. And he thought really they'd underachieved for about a decade in terms of playoff success. Sometime in the last week, he made the decision. He said he woke up on Monday after the loss to the Steelers and was pretty sure he was going to do it. He got to the point that day where he did not feel he would feel regret. And he said, reiterate, there's no perfect time ever to make these changes, but he made the decision on Monday. Jeff Zrebeck asked if he spoke to Lamar before making the decision. He said he talked to a bunch of veterans. Lamar was one of them. He said Lamar is very non-confrontational, and he had a lot of trailing things that didn't really lead to a point on that specifically, meaning he would not answer directly the question of whether Lamar said, yeah, you need to fire John, or yeah, it's time to move on kind of thing. He didn't go there. He said the players did not have a large hand in the decision. It was more like 80% from the department head. So when he's talking about that, he's talking about Sashi Brown. He's talking about Ozzie, who I think technically reports to DaCosta. That might not be true, but I thought he reported to DaCosta. But he's including him as a high-level authority on this one. And, of course, Eric as well. What else is there? Told Lamar the position was set at the end of his Monday night call with him, but he did not. He told him it wasn't a sure thing yet and he shouldn't say anything. So anyway, he left it that way. So I think he really confided in Lamar in a way is what I would take from that. Then we learned that he fired him over the phone and talked a little bit about that. He said he was sorry to have to do it over the phone. But John was in his car on the way home and Steve B was at his home, and he didn't want to say meet me at the castle in an office in an hour. He thought that would have been kind of a, I don't know if he used the term dick move, but a non-cool move, an uncool move to do that. And so he just said, you know, I'm sorry this has to be here. But what he found is that Harbaugh's response to them was, you know, you don't owe me anything. You took a chance on me as a special teams coordinator 18 years ago. And he was really consoling Steve Bisciotti over the firing. Most of it was him feeling bad about having to deliver this news. He had a follow-up call with John on Thursday, he said, encouraged him to take a year off. And he made an interesting comment. And despite there's a significant offset payment, he said he was more than happy to have John take a long paid vacation at his expense, effectively, because he might not have to pay him some portion of his salary. But in any case, he says John is interviewing from a position of his strength for his next job, and soon certainly is going to land on his feet is the expectation. One of the reasons he said was kind of interesting, and I can definitely get right into this. We've made the point, even though it doesn't look like it, that John is 1 year older than me. And Maureen and I are already talking about what vacations can we take now that we won't be able to when we're 75. And you, these things are things you really think about at my age. And John Harbaugh being 63, Bisciotti encouraged him, do the things you can do now. You might not be able to do them when you're 75 and you next quit coaching. say. The point was made a number of times during the things. It's an 80-hour work week. I think it must be a very physically demanding job, not just mentally. Just the amount of hours, the amount of lost sleep that is incurred is very significant. For Steve, this was just the second hiring of a new head coach. The question was, does the next head coach get the "you need to get to the Super Bowl fast" speech? He said it took Billick 2 years, Harbaugh 5 years, maybe the next guy gets 6 years. And then there were a bunch of laughs from the crowd, but with the specificity of that. But that came up again later when they talked about being sure about the pick in the hiring process so they could afford to be patient. And so it's an interesting thing. It's 6 years, seems like an awfully long time to give a new guy coming into a very good situation. This isn't the 1999 Ravens that Billick is inheriting with some significant problems. And before a lot of Ozzie's amazing streak of free agents really had hit home. But it's a much better position than Billick inherited. And it's certainly a much better position than Harbaugh inherited without the quarterback in house. So for the extra time to be on this side, I kind of doubt that it will live to that sort of fruition. It was asked about the importance of the Lamar Jackson extension. That was Mink to DaCosta. And he said it would certainly give us additional roster flexibility. We have a nest egg that we've accumulated, and some of that was, of course, from trading Adafi Owe. They've acquired a little bit more draft capital available, but they would like to have more money to sign better players to supplement the roster this year. Jonas Schaefer asked, what are they looking for in terms of a new coach? And this was interesting. Steve Bisciotti said he was intrigued by coaches who were the hottest OC/DC candidates 6 to 7 years ago. Now, this is really specific because I think there are two coaches who basically are a couple rungs up on the ladder because of this. He also added that they will judge a previous failure with regard to his circumstances, a previous head coaching failure with regard to his circumstances, which might mean a coach with a losing record, and there are two big ones out there, Saleh and Stefanski, would have a leg up in the process. So I would say that is a very big deal. He said it would be the easy thing to do to hire an offensive coordinator or defensive coordinator for their first job. Then he'd take less heat about the fact that he'd hired a losing coach, particularly if that losing coach continued to lose. But it didn't necessarily make it the right move. And so they were going to trust their own instincts there. And again, I'm paraphrasing what they've said. He did say, and this was very interesting, that whoever was head coach was going to hire their own OC and DC. Well, you know, one of the points that's made is, do you want a guy who just coaches one side of the ball? And then maybe you don't have an offensive coordinator the same way. You have a quarterback's coach and you have a quality control coach, but you don't have anybody specifically named the offensive coordinator. Or maybe you do, and your offensive coordinator doesn't have any real power. You know, their actual job is offensive quality control or, any number of other subsets of an offensive coordinator role that you might assign him. So I thought that was interesting as well. But if I were to say something about that, I'd say that Bisciotti probably favors the CEO head coach role. And so if he's already structuring it, so he expects his guy to hire both a DC and an OC. Well, first, he's leaving the hiring process to him. But second of all, he was kind of indicating that he likes the CEO head coach model. And I will point out to the fact that he also said that there's probably 12 or 15 teams in the NFL who currently have a head coach who's calling offensive plays, specifically offensive plays. So he also may be more amenable to such things. There's some mixed messages in this, by the way. I'm doing the best I can to interpret what I think is really going on with that. He was asked then, what was his evaluation of Eric DaCosta? And will the chain of command remain the same? I think that might have been Luke Jones who asked the question. He said, good question. He said, Eric is one of the best GMs in the league. Eric is batting 800. And was worried he had a hand in John Harbaugh's hiring, meaning he was critical of himself and his own moves during the offseason, you know, not maybe getting the Ravens the pass rush strength they needed. And, you know, he was very critical of himself and self-effacing. With regard to the chain of command, he says he doesn't think it matters, that he'd lived in a system for years where John Harbaugh and Eric DaCosta would come to him if they needed a tiebreaker on a vote because they're in separate silos. But that never happened. So, you know, he was comfortable, I think, with that. And I think we'll see that as kind of a continued bedrock foundation. I really do not see any situation where the new head coach then reports to Eric DaCosta. I really do not see that happening. It is conceivable that there is a dotted line of reporting between DaCosta and a new head coach. With a younger head coach, you know, he did mention that, Eric was going to have to mentor this, a new head coach in terms of his role in the organization and what's going on and whatnot. So I'd expect that sort of a relationship, but I really don't expect a one has the power over the other to be changed. And he also said, he didn't want to burden Eric with that. And I think that's a fairly clear indication. We're not going to go to that. He also joked about how he invented working remotely long before COVID, that he's always been somewhere else. And so any questions would have had to come up would have had to, be done by a remote conversation or whatever anyway, but they never did. Cordell Woodland asked, are you looking for college coaches? And he said, this was, I think, of EDC is asking us. He didn't know, but they hadn't reached out to any college coaches. Eric DaCosta was texting Lamar after every interview, and Steve Bisciotti told him he'd have to be in Baltimore for the interviews if he wanted to be involved in this. He offered to provide a plane to do so. He mentioned that Lamar, you know, would have input on this, and then he mentioned again at the end of the press conference that Lamar's opinion is valued. Lamar would have a say, but ultimately the decision is his. It's not anybody else's. It's his. And so he's going to, you know, I think try and build a consensus. But in the end, if that differs from what his gut is, I think he'll go with his gut. And, you know, we're kind of fortunate in Baltimore that Steve Bisciotti has been such a good hiring manager over the years, has had so few total hires he's had to worry about. And I'm not talking about Sashi Brown because that's not a football operations move, but I am talking about the fact that he's only hired two head coaches in 25 years, Billick. The Billick for Harbaugh move had to be done, and the Harbaugh for whoever move had to be done. But the only other move he's made is a move that is largely a soft move to move Eric DaCosta into the GM role and give it that to him over Ozzie. But he retained Ozzie at a very high level, which is very clear from this hiring process. So the number of total moves that Steve Bisciotti's had to be involved in over the years, despite the fact that there are four silos that all report directly to him, has been very, very few. Now, he did put Sashi Brown in the president role after Dick Cash retired, but that wasn't a firing either, and it's not a football operations move. So there are reasons why that job is important, and you know, you want to have guys who maximize revenue for the team and whatnot, but it's just not a football operations move, so it's not in the same spot. All right, there was the he also made the point that he didn't think a college coach he did think college coaches would want to get a pro job to get away from the NIL recruiting portal. He thought that was just hell on earth for the people who were in that spot. But there's no indication that they're going after a college guy. There's no indication at all that interviews are being held with college people is what I took from this. Mike Preston then asked the question. He said some funny things about Preston this I'm not going to get into, but asked the question because Mike Tomlin had just been fired or parted ways with the Steelers. Like, apparently that happened today, and I haven't been privy to it. Might have happened while the interviews were going on, actually. He said, is Mike a candidate? And he said, I love Mike, good for Mike, but talk to EDC. So EDC is obviously gonna bring up it. And he also said something else that Mike had made some gesture or something at the end of the game that he didn't like. And he thought, wow, that puts him out for me kind of thing. I think it was just a joke, but you know, he obviously thinks highly of Mike Tomlin. But the talk to EDC comment, which was one of several in this process, is one of the very clear indications of exactly who's in charge of this hiring process. It is EDC's circus to run. He's eventually going to be the judge of the circus, but it's EDC's circus to run. Let's see. Gianna Han asked him about Nnamdi Matabike and if they could provide an update on his situation. EDC said he couldn't discuss it. And there was some talk about, you know, things that were going on, but it's been the same sort of non-talk that we got from Harbaugh during the season. So obviously, it may be a case where Nnamdi thinks he may be able to play again and wants to do things to try and play again, and the team can't comment with regard to to his health or the specific injury type. So there's nothing really for them to report at this point. What do you see as the biggest failures to build the roster on your end? Was something, I think it was Valerie Pirakter, it was a female voice, could have been Morgan Adsit, asked to Eric DaCosta and said, they have to do a better job of creating pressure. And they did think that it made the point that Nnamdi Matabike's injury impacted both Travis Jones and Kyle Van Noy. They thought that, that was a big deal. He said that, I think it was DaCosta and not Bisciotti, but sometimes in these questions where two people are asking, I lose track of exactly who answered what. And I think it was Eric said that Travis Jones would have been a wrecking ball if he'd have been single all season because Nnamdi was there. And that's just not the way that works. I mean, Travis Jones is the one who commands double teams and gets many more of them. Even, you know, he forced a lot of one-on-one action for Nnamdi. But it's true that you know, anytime you can set up Travis Jones with one-on-one opportunities is really a special opportunity. I think that's one of the really nice things they have going to this next draft is they have the opportunity to use Travis Jones as either a one or three tech, which means they can draft either a one or three tech for their primary defensive line selection they make, which I would expect to be one of the first two rounds. So, you know, Woods would be a possibility, for example, in which case we might see Travis Jones still at nose tackle. If they went to a nose tackle in a later round, it could be that Jones moves to the three tech and plays that fully, and they have a running mate with him they like at the nose. That would be good. So anyway, the interesting thing about this particular question was Steve jumped in at the end and said, the coaches need to take a share of this as well. It's not just the players and it's not just Eric. It's the offensive line did not develop as expected. That was a wow moment. And I think that certainly any question of whether or not Warhop is going to be with a team in 2026, I would take as decided by that response from Steve B. But also, you know, you're hiring a new head coach. They're probably going to have pretty strong feelings about bringing in their own offensive line guy. But if they didn't have an offensive line guy, maybe they'd be okay with the current guy. But the best, most highest reason why a guy would remain is because he's protected by organizational culture that already exists. So if Joe D were still here, he'd probably be protected. But in the case of Warhop, I don't believe he is. And he may be able to interview for his job with a new head coach, but I don't anticipate that he'll be around in 2026. Bisciotti was asked if the fans' voices played a part in his decision. And that was Pete Gilbert asked that question. He said, not that important, honestly. The volume went up and it turned on John as the year went on. It was something that impacted him in terms of him listening to it, but not in the way you'd expect. He said he couldn't stand people attacking his friend. John Harbaugh is not my friend specifically, but I don't like hearing John Harbaugh attacked for bullshit reasons. I do not appreciate that either. And I think people who don't really understand the thing, it's utter silliness. So, it is where it is. He didn't like it for that reason. I'm okay with that. Part of his thought process, he said, was that John Harbaugh would be relieved of all of that basically Twitterverse misery that he's set to. He said, going backwards the last 3 years was really the big factor. They went, and he specifically said, we went from AFC championship game to division round exit to not making the playoffs. So that, I think, was one of the strongest things he said about why expectations had not been met. Garrett Downing asked the question of Eric DaCosta, what are you looking for in the new head coach? And he said, the best leaders that hold players accountable, an X's and O's guy, and someone who will continue the culture. Okay, so I think those are all very good and central points. And Eric's better at trimming that down to a specific answer. He may have had this question in advance because Garrett is, of course, an employee of the Ravens, so he may have had that question in advance, but he knew how to answer it in a terse manner that I think was very effective in this case. One of the things they said that every day, companies you've never heard of are making millions off your personal data. Your name, address, phone number, even details about your family are pulled from public records on the internet, then sold without your consent. There's an entire marketplace built on your privacy, and most people have no idea it exists. Aura fights back. Aura removes your personal data from broker sites and keeps it off. Aura also alerts you fast if your information shows up in a breach or on the dark web. But Aura is more than just a data broker removal system. It's a full digital security suite that protects every part of your online life. Aura gives you a VPN to stay private, antivirus to block threats, a password manager for safer logins, and spam call protection to shut down scammers. Aura scans the dark web for your most sensitive information and notifies you instantly if anything is exposed. And if your identity is ever stolen, you're backed by up to $5 billion in insurance and 24/7 U.S.-based fraud support. Other service charges about the same, but only cover one or two areas. Aura gives you everything: data broker removal, identity and credit monitoring, device protection, and fraud support, all in one simple app. Aura removes what's already exposed, protects what's not, and puts you back in control. Go to aura.com/remove for complete digital protection and peace of mind. That's aura.com/remove.
Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's changing the game. Mood.com. They created an entirely line of functional gummies, 100% federally legal THC blends, discreetly delivered right to your doorstep. And here's the best part. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with the promo code Ravens. Now, I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself. Each one's totally unique. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out right away. They help me unwind fast, leave me refreshed the next morning. The Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for when your day just isn't going the way you want it to go. What makes Mood special is how they pair the THC with natural herbs and adaptogens. You won't find blends like this at any local shop. They've got gummies designed for focus, relaxation, clarity, even energy, all made from cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no shortcuts, just high-quality weed you can trust. Plus, Mood backs everything with a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. So head on over to Mood.com, check out their amazing selection, and don't forget to use the promo code Ravens at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
Eric said was that coaches clearly covet this job, its continuity, and of the continuity of the organization, and the players involved. He's new to this process personally. He said he's received a huge number of phone calls, and it's been a matter of media, national and local, calls from college coaches and calls from other coaches who want to be a part of the Baltimore Ravens. So it really is the job in football that is the most sought after. And that won't change, by the way, if the Steelers job is open. Lamar Jackson is an incredible drawing card for the Baltimore Ravens. Childs Walker asked, do you sense Lamar wants to re-sign, and do you want him to be a central figure in the organization? So I think he's asking, do you want, you know, Lamar to turn into a Johnny Unitas figure where he's almost got a role that's as significant as the head coach in terms of directing the culture of the organization? He said, I want him to be our quarterback. And that's exactly the answer that I want to hear as a fan. I would love to have Lamar take an active role in discussing how the head coach, you know, what head coach quality should be there. But I only want him to do it under two circumstances. One is if he has meaningful things to say. And two is if he really wants to be a part of the process, meaning you really got to sit down and try and understand what's going on and then make judgments based on that. And then really ask the question. If you want to ask the self-interested questions of, look, I want to understand how this affects me. I want more control at the line of scrimmage. I want this. I want that. That's absolutely fine after you've committed to these first two things that I'm talking about. So I think that was a good answer from Steve. He said they want to re-sign him. The annual number, of course, will be higher, but he hopes the structure is very similar to what they currently have in place. So, you know, hopefully they can use the same contract, just put in higher numbers. And that's a good answer. You know, I hope it's that simple too. He says there's an urgency to do it with free agency starting, and Lamar appreciates his stance in that regard, and he wants to provide Eric DaCosta with, you know, a clear ability to handle free agency as effectively as possible. Doesn't want this to drag out into April. So he's, you know, he really wants to have this prior to free agency, have the Lamar contract situation resolved. Garrett DeBarkin, who I do not know, asked a question about hiring lessons learned from other businesses. And he said he's made his life betting on people with thin resumes and using his gut to do that. He thinks now, after all the years in the NFL, he's had 25 years really in the NFL, he's relying more on his NFL experience. He's much more interested in the viewpoints of Sasha, Eric, and Ozzie, who will work with him daily. And so that's making clear who the panel of three is. And he had an interesting sidelight here. He talked about, you know, 15 or 20 years ago, he was really interested in becoming one of the Hall of Fame type owners, somebody who would have a gold jacket himself one day. And then finally he had to just, he looked at it and saw, you know, the Rooneys and the Maras who've gotten to that point, that they had to continue working at a level that wasn't just fair to his family and his wife in particular. He told his wife that he wanted to do this as a hobby, not as a full-time job, and he wanted to stick to that promise. And so he backed off that, and he's no longer trying to be a Hall of Fame owner, although I will say he's very special in terms of the continuity he's brought to this organization, and I'm not sure that won't weigh in his favor. There was a later question about how much longer is going to be owner that I'll get to in a few minutes, because I want to be at the right point in my notes here when I give that. But he did clarify that he's only going to be there for the last five interviews, and he'll be directly involved. But he clarified again that Eric DaCosta is in charge of the process. So multiple times during this thing, this came out. You know, talk to Eric. Eric's in charge of the process, et cetera, et cetera. Jerry Coleman asked a question. Good Jerry Coleman question here. If Tyler Loop makes that field goal, is John Harbaugh still coaching? Took a sip of his water, and then he put it down. And he said, for a week. And, you know, basically indicating that if the same thing had happened to Harbaugh that happened to Tomlin in that first playoff game, that he probably would have been just as upset. That's at least the way I take it. Now, if John Harbaugh wins a playoff game, gets the divisional round, maybe even gets beyond that, I think the answer is different. So this 4 week was a flippant answer, but it did not get laughs. It was clearly a serious answer there. He was also asked, said they hadn't heard anything on his Justin Tucker reaction. And we hadn't talked to him since all of that happened. He said, I defer to Eric on that. And then Eric didn't have anything to say. Bisciotti got the microphone back and said he feels really bad for Tyler Loop, but he thinks he'll learn from that and be a great kicker. And Eric really echoed that comment, is said, you know, he had a great rookie year. He'll be fine. All right. There was a female voice, I don't know who it was, who said, what's the timeline for the process? DaCosta said he thought it was like a three-week NFL draft. Get as many interviews as possible done. You Zoom for the initial round. There are 8 to 9 more interviews between now and Sunday. Said maybe a couple more after that, but they would whittle the list down to 15 interviews, down to the best 5 for in-person interviews. He might have said the best 4 to 5, but you know, the intention is still the same there. Those are going to be one day each, and they'd have to come up with a schedule for that. He feels they need to fill out the staff no later than very closely after the Super Bowl. Now, there were questions like when McDonald was hired by the Seahawks, they had to wait to even interview him for the first time until after the Ravens AFC Championship game loss. So he doesn't think that's too late, apparently, but they need to have the head coach clearly hired, I would say, before the Super Bowl. I would expect that if they're going through Sunday, then they're going to have a schedule that will take them one more week. Sunday, this is Tuesday, it was the 18th, the 25th, would be the following week that I think the interviews, the in-person interviews will be conducted. I think we'll have a coaching hire in Baltimore by about January 26th or 27th. No later than certainly than the end of that week. I don't imagine there'll be a second round of interviews or this or that. I think we'll know. There may be some negotiations. There may be somebody holds them up because they're looking at multiple jobs, but I don't think on the Ravens end. I think they would see this ending around the 26th or the 27th. Again, that was not specific, but it was more like what the timeline was here. So we've only been 6 days in or 7 days in so far, if you want to think about that. So if he's saying it's a three-week NFL draft, that means 2 weeks from today, he would have it, and that would put you at the 27th. So I think that's a pretty good estimate of when this might end. Carita Parks, I think, asked, what will the patience level be for the new coach, and what will your measures of success be? And Bisciotti, you know, answered it from the negative. He said, we'll measure his contributions if we fail, his contributions to failure. And he said he certainly hopes to overachieve, return to the playoffs. But we're going to make sure that our choice is someone that deserves patience effectively, that we're going to make such a good choice that we're going to be able to be patient with this next hire. That kind of fits in with his early 6 year thing. He did mention, you know, 4 years is kind of a typical length of time a head coach gets. But this is, you know, I think he's talking probably about a little bit more than this, which still means, and I'm happy about this, that Steve Bisciotti is more of a long-term viewpoint guy than some of the other, you know, less continuous NFL organizations like the Jets, who've had much more turnover in that role. So, you know, I think that was a good answer. Said, I asked about the communication between Lamar and the coaches. And this is a question for EDC. I could not tell who the voice was that asked it. But he said, you always need to improve as a communicator. You need to set expectations and hold people accountable every single day. That includes scouts, coaches, and players. It's probably part of a central tenet as opposed to a rehearsed answer is the way I interpreted it, just listening to it. But I thought it's a great answer from EDC, that you as good as you think you are as a communicator, you better always strive to be better. Alex G asked, with EDC, Ozzie, and Sasha involved. I don't have the question here that was asked. Let me get to the answer. Yes, he was asking about whether a person with experience with the Ravens might be favored over a completely fresh outsider to try and bring a new culture to the organization. And Steve Bisciotti said he hopes Eric will be able to filter out organizational knowledge as it helps, and I'm now paraphrasing, someone to put on an interview performance. So the guy I would think, well, a couple people really, this matters for. It matters for Jesse Minter, who they're gonna look at. It matters for Eric Dakota, for Anthony Weaver, and it matters for other people who've worked at any time really with the organization before, that they wouldn't be able to couch their interview in such a way that they're giving the answers that they know the Ravens want to hear in the way they want. He says he hopes Eric will be able to filter that out. But that's also something that Bisciotti will have the final authority in the hiring decision at the end of this process. All right. This is an interesting question from Kyle Goon. Asked about what's the timeline for a change in ownership? And he talked about being 80 in 15 years. So he's 65 now. He's already decided he does not want to pass the franchise down to the family. I talked about succession risks on the video. What I meant by that is Succession, the TV show, risks, meaning families get torn apart by a desire to control the resulting organization. So it might be a case where Bisciotti has more than one a child who wants it, or it may be a case where Steve never wants to put himself in a position where he has to even worry about that. And I don't actually know how many kids Steve B has. So who knows? There may be no one in any case who really wants it. It's a huge tax liability when an owner dies to move that to the next generation. And to do so might take up quite a bit of his entire fortune. And his fortune is vast, certainly is the richest man in Maryland, but it would be to pass on a team that's worth, say, $3 or $4 billion is going to, right off the top in Maryland, cost him about $2 billion of that. So he's going to have to find a way to, you know, fund that tax bill, and that could be most of the remainder of the money he has. So it would be a difficult process. And you if you give all that to one child, it would be completely unfair. So, you know, if you have an estate, you know, you probably are very familiar with this problem. Is you one thing you really want is you don't want your kids to be angry with you after the fact. You want to keep things going. And to the degree there's somebody involved in the family business already, you might want to pass that on and respect the amount of effort they put in. I don't sense there's anybody in the Bisciotti family who's currently involved in the family business. I could be wrong, but I've never heard a name included in the family business so far. But if were that to change, I suppose it could change there. And he says he wants to win a couple Super Bowls and get the hell out. So I think that's a good way to go. And I'm actually already worried about who will be the next owner of the Baltimore Ravens and what the hell will they be like, because I can't imagine them being as good as Steve B has been. Eric DaCosta got a question. This is from Kelvin Richardson. He asked about whether or not he was open to trades for an elite player. And he's talking about either trading up in round one or trading for an elite player. And I think the implication was Micah Parsons. Eric DaCosta said there was a trade they were working on at the trade deadline. I don't know what that was, whether or not it might have involved Myles Garrett or somebody else that they were thinking about picking. But he made the point that I always make, which is the combination of draft capital and cap cost is often prohibitive. And it's very dangerous to be of the mindset that you are one player away. It's a great way to fall flat on your face and then have a huge bill you haven't paid in terms of future draft capital and cap costs that is going to then come due. So I thought a good answer for that. It's exactly the answer I want. It's consistent with what you've always heard on this podcast in terms of my approach to looking at roster building. Said the best way of building is through the draft. They'll participate in trades. They'll participate in UFAs, but it's always going to be right player, right price. You know that, and I think if you're one of these people that's always saying, let's go out and get this player because he'll make all the difference, and Micah Parsons was the guy last year, you know, you're probably always going to be frustrated with the way this organization is run, at least under the DaCosta regime. Might be time to find a new team, because I don't think they're finding a new general manager. He mentioned that Lamar was invited up for the meetings. We talked about that already. I think I've gone through all the elements of that. He was asked, this is a good one. Why did you stop the State of the Ravens press conferences? Now, they actually have two State of the Ravens meetings that they have. The one is a Sweetholder event, which is, that is fantastic. Just an outstanding event. You get to go, and there's usually one or two players or one current player and a couple of former players, along with a lot of the brass for the organization. Certainly the head coach, Eric, would be involved, and so would Dick Cass in the past, or Sashi Brown currently. So a lot of opportunity to ask whatever question you want. And there's a, after they do a group discussion, which involves some of the worst questions you'll ever hear, where CEOs prattle on for about 2 minutes trying to act smart about their questions, and then they answer them in 10 seconds. You have that, and that's less useful. And then you have a, you know, kind of a cocktail hour you spend together. That thing is fantastic. So if you ever get a chance to go to that, if your company has tickets to that because they have suite tickets, fantastic thing. And it makes very clear that the Ravens look at their stakeholders in tiers. So you have your Sweetholders, they're the highest level, and they talk directly to them about how they need to have their revenue be in the top half of the league, and here's what we need to do it. And you know, the Sweetholders are a big part of that, and they know it, and they say so. And then you have your PSL holders, and they're your bedrock group that the organization depends on. They need the seats to be filled to be in the top half of the league in revenue also. And it's not an easy task at times, particularly given the small area that Baltimore has to work with in terms of the fan base. So they're very good about that. And then there's everybody else. And frankly, If you're not a season ticket holder, then you're a general NFL customer. Perhaps if you buy Sunday Ticket or if you buy NFL Pro or you do this, but honestly, you're not really on the radar. And that's why some of the answers I think that come from EDC about not really being significantly concerned about what the fans, the talk radio view of the fans is. A lot of it comes from exactly that. He doesn't say directly that you need to be a stakeholder to have a say, but I think it's kind of implicit in what he's saying there. So I think he's very practical about knowing what stakeholders needed to be treated at what sort of different level. And so you get a little bit different depending on at which of those three levels you are. The other thing, he had a flip comment. He said, like Seinfeld, I ran out of good material. And then he railed on Seinfeld for about another 30 seconds for doing 80 shows a year of stand-up after that. But more importantly, said he didn't see the benefit of being up on the podium and dissecting divisional round losses. He said, I got tired of coming up here and trying to, pick apart the exact reason for these losses. And there's always a risk of him putting his foot in his mouth. By the way, very important thing to know if you're a public speaker, try to know when it's a good chance that you might put your foot in your mouth. He said the big opportunity he has with his own leaders is the Jupiter meeting. Then he really grills his individual leaders on his plan. Jupiter, Florida is where his home is. And they go down there each year. He kind of made light of the fact that he always gets told by Eric that he doesn't have time for it. I've got a draft to run here. And so they have to kind of work around that schedule. But that's his opportunity to really get involved with the top levels of leadership within the organization. Made a closing statement, not really under that vein, but it was the last question was done. He said it was a difficult decision, but he wanted the fans and the media to respect that he was 100% sure it was the right decision when he made it. And he appreciated the lack of questions about the sordid details. So of what players said that John wasn't doing his job or communicating with them, or what exact reasons there were, or did he say something that ticked you off, or that sort of thing. He appreciated those questions were not included in this meeting. And I'm not sure it matters. So, why should we care? He mentioned that John Harbaugh was Eric DaCosta's best friend and questioned his distance to make the call. So in the end, he took that out of his hands. Not that I think DaCosta had it, but he would have maybe relied on DaCosta's opinion about it. And then he just said, look, I'm doing it. And I think probably that's a pretty clear indication that Eric would have liked to run it back for one more year with John Harbaugh at the helm. But Steve B. basically saw the friendship between those two and said, okay, I need to override this and make a move. So anyway, that's it for the press conference. Very good. I think some fairly deep information, a lot between the lines that went on here. Appreciate you folks for listening. Please use hashtag film study mailbag for questions you might have, whether it's about the coaching changes, which we'll probably try and talk about on Friday Morning GM or other individual pods that we have, or anything else that might relate to season reviews by position, which are going on right now. I'll try and get your questions to the appropriate position group. And there are 12 of those, including specialists that I'll be doing a review of. Thanks again for listening. And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.